A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP of Data Mesh Consulting Services at Starburst and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading sponsor for Trino, the open source project, and Jamak's Data Mesh book, delivering data-driven value at scale. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Stephanie Bergamo, who's the lead data engineer, and Simon Moron, who's a lead architect at LeBoncoin. Some key takeaways slash thoughts from Stephanie and Simon's point of view. Number one, bet on curious people. Just have people talk to each other and lower the cognitive costs of using the tooling are three kind of places that they wrapped up with. If you can do that, you'll raise your chance of success with your data mesh implementation. Number two, LeBoncoin requires teams to share information on the enterprise service bus that might not be directly useful to the originating domain when working on the operational plane. They're using a similar approach for data with data mesh, sharing information that might not be useful directly to the originating domain by default. And then if they find that people could use that information in a data product, then that gets prioritized and gets brought into an actual data product. But teams can kind of see what information is out there by default. Number three, LeBoncoin presses teams to get data requests to other teams early so that those teams can prioritize those data requests. There isn't an expectation of producing new data very quickly after a new request, which is probably a healthy approach to data work and data collaboration. Number four, embedding a data engineer into a domain doesn't suddenly make everything easy. It's not magic. Software engineers will need a lot of training and help to really understand data engineering practices. Tooling and frameworks can only go so far. Be prepared for friction there. Number five, similarly, getting data engineers to realize that data engineering is just software engineering, but for data, and to actually treat it as such, as real software engineering, might be even harder. Number six, software engineers generally don't know how to write good tests relative to data. Neither do data engineers. But testing is probably more important in data than in software. We all need to get better at testing relative to data. Number seven, start with building the self-service platform to solve the challenges of the data producers first. You may make it very easy to discover and consume data, but if the producers aren't producing any data or aren't producing quality data, then ... This seems to be something that is emerging as more of a trend as well, that you do have to make the self-serve platform for consumers, but that you should be starting more on getting the producers to a place where they can actually create new data products relatively easily and manage their existing data products. Number eight, if your software engineers are doing data pipelines at all before starting to work with them in a data mesh implementation, you can probably expect that they aren't using best practices or even really good practices. Number nine, It's pretty common for good slash best practices to be known by only a few people inside an organization, such as with a specialty-focused guild. Look for ways to cross-pollinate information on how to do a lot of different practices, whether that's, you know, data engineering or DevOps or all sorts of different things, infrastructure as code. Look for ways to cross-pollinate that information so more people are at least aware of best practices, if not fully able to implement them yet. Number 10, trying to force people to share data in a data mesh type of way didn't work for LeBoncoin and probably won't in most organizations. Find curious developers and help them accomplish something with data. That will drive buy-in for them and for other people who can see that something got done with data. Number 11, as part of the previous number 10, data products often start as something serving the producing domain and then evolve to serve additional use cases at LeBoncoin. They start by serving a specific business need and evolve from there. And finally, number 12, look to build your tooling to enforce your data governance requirements / needs. Trying to put too much on the plate of software engineers probably won't go well. So I think you'll learn a lot from this one. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. So very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Stephanie Bergamo and Simon Moron from LeBoncoin. Stephanie is the lead data engineer and Simon is the lead architect. And the reason I asked them to be on was LeBoncoin has actually been somebody who was one of the first to actually have even a presentation around data mesh when they asked Max Schulze to be on at one of their conferences last year. So I've kind of been aware of what they've been doing and moving towards this. And I think it's a really interesting story. LeBoncoin is actually part of Adavinta, and Javier Gumaro Ragol was on previously, but they kind of have a separate journey. So I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation. We're going to cover a lot of things, some of the stuff that's gone well, which we always have with all the journey stories, but also some challenges that I think are good to get out there and say, like, how are people handling these types of challenges? So with that, Stephanie, Simon, if you don't mind, if you could give people a bit of an introduction to yourself, and then we'll jump into the conversation at hand.
Okay, I'll start. I'm Stephanie. Today, I'm a lead data engineer at LeBoncoin, but before, I was a software engineer at Algolia, a search engine. And I was still building data pipelines. And before that, I was a manager. I was Simon manager, actually, here at LeBoncoin too. I just left for 4 years and came back building pipelines.
Yeah, but not because of me.
Not because of you.
I'm Simon. I presently work as a lead architect at LeBoncoin. But I'm a former BI engineer and data engineer and data architect. Now I'm working more transversally with all our feature teams, but data mesh is one on my main topics.
Awesome. So I think it might be helpful to talk about kind of what caused you to even start looking at data mesh. Like what was the journey? You know, we talked a little bit about your data engineering history, but like, what was the journey for LeBoncoin to start to think about why you would want to take on something as challenging as data mesh? This is not a kind of free switch to flip. It's not something that's easy to do. And so what were the challenges? What's the overall history and what were the challenges you were seeing that led you to want to even take this on?
I can think two main things. The first one was we were definitively feeling the pain that Zamak described in the first article. Le Bon Coin is a continuously growing company. And in 2019, when the first article went out, our data team were fully centralized, and other teams was organized in a Spotify fashion, feature teams, and growing exponentially. And so we started to suffer from very long time to market for data-driven system. At the same time, we were building the first machine learning services. And so the part describing the limits of the centralization approach really spoke to us at this point. That's the first point. And the other one was that we felt to be already at the middle of the journey, as we already had some kind of decentralized data governance and some strong norms around data streams and schema handling, etc. And also the data ownership was also already on the feature team part. So the teams that was owning the business domain was also handling the schema management, the producer logic, etc. So we were, I think halfway with the Norman governance part.
Yeah, and so when we first talked, you talked about the kind of evolutionary path, right? Like in 2012, you were just kind of getting your first BI solutions out there, and then moved on to the data platform, and you were seeing these ML kind of concepts. So like, was it something that you read Zamak's article and everyone was like, okay, we're going to go down this path? Because I don't think that's a common thing of people going, okay, we've kind of already headed down this, so this is exactly our roadmap, versus like the conversation internally of, hey, should this be something we pursue? How would we actually mold this to be, you know, this is kind of, it's an approach, but it's not a specific roadmap, and we have to adapt it to our own organization. You know, I say adapt to adopt, right? Because if you just try and say, oh, we're going to do the purely theoretical data mesh, it's not going to work because it's not going to fit with your actual organization. So, you know, could you talk about what you've kind of done thus far? What maybe some paths that you found that are working, and some things that maybe didn't work, and that you're really going down that are, just would love to hear kind of the differences there.
I think first the chance we had was that we were organized in a feature team already, so with pluridisciplinary teams, just lacking data skills. And when the article went out, we already had the pain of being super late in terms of data product. And maybe we saw that as an experiment we could do. Like we built at this time the first recommendation team, I think.
Yeah.
So we had a use case, and we thought, let's try to do something like data mesh, and maybe this is the solution. Maybe we have to adapt to our culture. And I won't say we are today fully in a data mesh organization, but we're trying what is working and what is not. And maybe you want to add stuff because you were there.
So we at this time we negotiated with our CTO to test the approach on a limited number of teams. I think there were something like 30 teams at the time. So we built for the recommendation system, we built a feature team as the others. That was the first time we had a team that was that had been incubated in the data teams that was going the other side of the IT organization. We added some data engineers inside some teams that had
obvious.
So we added some data engineers in teams that had obvious needs, but they were few. And we also started to invest in tooling at this moment pretty heavily to really make the data infra self-serve platform emerge. And that was our main moves. So we had kind of an internal platform that is basically a CI/CD stuff. That from, you have a repo when developers can push description of a data infrastructure with high level of abstraction. Basically, it's mainly JSON file saying, okay, I need a job queue, an event stream, a tracking topic, etc. Adding some parameters on the t-shirt sizing, on the privacy, on the criticality of privacy relative information inside the topic with the owner, who are the consumers, with the producer, and enable also all the access control stuff. And we saw immediately a very good traction on this kind of on the adoption of this kind of tool, and that's for all developers, backend developers and data engineers. And so we, from this point, we invested regularly in our internal tooling, adding a search engine on top of our pre-existing data catalog, adding some self-serve services for testing testing data quality, and then go to more ML-centric stuff like feature stores, etc. It was a very long sentence. Steph, do you want to add something?
I was just thinking about the stuff that didn't work. And I think something we are maybe suffering is the kind of distance we have or we historically have between the data teams and the software engineering teams. Like historically, it was two different not business unit but
departments.
So it's kind of hard today to not that hard because we are smart people talking to each other. But still, I think there is some kind of distance when trying to work on some common stuff between data engineers and soft backend engineers, maybe.
Yeah, I think the first step was to convince data engineers that the data engineering is software engineering.
Yeah,
is software engineering, and you have to to converge with other software engineers. To have your own CI/CD, to have your test strategy, to thought about what your interfaces with the rest of the company are? What is your, what are your service level agreements, etc. And that was an important part. But we also had the reverse conversation with what we call software engineer or back engineers, and making them understand that the data engineering was not something different of what they were doing, and they also were able to build data pipelines and ETL streaming apps, etc., and use them to build the software as
or at least to gain interest in that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think this is a common occurrence of the software engineers and the data engineers. They have been completely two different camps, and that they're focused on the first word of the title of software and data instead of the second word of engineer and engineers, right? And so getting those people in the same room and getting them to, you know, in domain-driven design terms, there's the concept of the ubiquitous language, which is, yeah, you know, the language that both sides speak, where you can actually understand each other. And historically, that's been kind of tickets, right, of flowing tickets back and forth between each other instead of actually having the conversation and having a high context exchange. Because, you know, Jessitron, on her episode, you know, she's from the software engineering world. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, if you bring up DBT, and she just said, well, what's DBT? And I think if you said that in the data engineering world, that people would just look at you like you're kind of crazy. How have you never heard of DBT? It's like it's not part of their world. It's not the same language. So like to actually get them bought in, it's difficult in a lot of ways, because a lot of times they feel like they don't have those capabilities. So yeah, it's good that you're recognizing that you might have software engineers, you have the capability to do data pipelines. Now let's work with you to get them so that you're doing it well, right? Because you don't know best practices. You know how to get the job done, but it might be the small job instead of the long-term job or the reliable way of doing it. And
yeah,
things
like yeah, that. Because in fact, at the beginning, even this data pipeline approach was on a total blind spot for most of the teams. They even don't think they were able to use them, but even that they exist.
They didn't care about it.
Yeah, and so we saw terrific, horrible workaround for building batch oriented data pipeline with stuff that are absolutely not
good practices.
Yeah, good for that. trying to build backend services that are launched one year by a contact that someone has to think to update, to make one batch transformation inside a Postgres database and reload. We saw horrible stuff, and when you just put your architect hat and just say, what don't you use S3 for that, and put a simple Spark or Athena transformation on top of it? People look at you with some eyes, and with eyes open largely, and what? Yeah, exactly. They were. Not fun. For us, all that was data stuff, and data stuff was not their stuff and not their concerns.
Yeah.
So make people communicate, and what was one of the first steps to try to make those two worlds converge.
Yeah, I liked the phrase you just said. I don't know if it was just offhand of that's just data stuff, right? Like we have to move past that concept with the software engineers of that's just data stuff versus no, it's all like I had a conversation recently about what we're trying to achieve with data mesh is the harmony of data, metadata, and code. And if all you're focused on is the code, right, as a software engineer, you're not really playing well into the overall organization. It's not that the application is the only part of the organization's, you know, kind of experiencing the real world, right? That there is so much more to what you're doing and that it's also not just the data, you know, it's not just the ones and zeros. It is, what does this actually mean? You software engineer, you know this better because you're the one who's designing it. You know what's actually happening. Let's talk about how we would, like, we want to equip you to do this, but how would we actually share what's happening with the rest of the organization? And I think that's not something that historically anybody's talked about. And it sounds like some philosophical mumbo jumbo type of things, just ridiculousness until you really start to say, but what are we trying to accomplish in why we share our data, why we care about this?
Yeah, but that's where also having some well-established concepts like data mesh can help, because it can facilitate the explanation of the vision, saying, yeah, you have this kind of pain, you want to go this way, to adopt this decentralized approach, give you back ownership also of what is happening in this big black box you call data platform, and that got people attention and help us to find some volunteers to try to use those tools on actual product related projects, and then share back with their peers what they have done and how satisfying it could be.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, they are enriching their own features.
Yeah.
And it's their product. So, yeah, it's pretty satisfying, yeah.
I think that one thing that helped us on this point is our community of practice for our guilds.
We have guilds like on the Spotify model.
Yeah, maybe can you...
Today we have multiple guilds I won't say technology, it's like by position, by speciality, no.
Capabilities, speciality. Capabilities,
maybe.
Yeah.
We have guild designed by...
In fact, it's an interesting part because the split between our guilds is mainly based on the organization we had before switching to the Spotify model. So way before going to data mesh. And so we had backend engineers. So we have a backend guild. We have data engineers. So we have a data engineering guild.
Web guild.
Exactly.
For the front end, the web front end part. We have an iOS one, an Android one.
But those guilds were based on organization and job descriptions we had 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I think they work pretty well and they are really actual way of having continuous improvements and that's good investment, I think, for LeBron. But maybe we should rethink our job position, job description, and have some more general job description and maybe some speciality in it. But I think we created too many silos.
Maybe because personally, I feel frustrated today by the guild. Because I'm a data engineer, and I am animating the data engineer guild. But I would love to go to the backend one. There is so many stuff to learn there, and I just can't. And the way we organized them, we can't move from one to another.
Yeah.
Or maybe we can, but we just don't know, or we just don't share it.
It's hard to do. They're an open guild, so basically you can, but they occur at the same time. And especially now we are full remote.
Yeah.
People from other guilds don't show up.
Yeah, and if I choose to go in the backend one, I can't go to the data engineering one. But so, it's a full company organization, so...
Well, yeah, and that I think that's kind of what you mentioned of the silos versus, you know, there is overlap where you say, okay, I'm doing these multiple things. Like I need to make it so that if I want to understand this one concept, that there's more of an open company-wide meeting of anybody who wants to learn on this specific concept, let's have that information sharing, you know, those internal meetups and things like that. I think that's interesting. Like even just on the call, I can see you all are rethinking, should we be doing this way? I think that's an interesting thing about Data Mesh is how often it makes you rethink, why are we doing things this way? Like what are we trying to achieve? And is this achieving that? And that, it really does bring to surface the amount of times you should question what, like, is this the way that we are actually going to derive the most value? So I think that could be a really interesting thing, Stephanie, specifically talking to your own experiences about what have you had to try to learn and what has been kind of a struggle to learn when, you know, you're your title is data engineer. And so you've talked about data engineers are software engineers and software engineers are data engineers. And you were previously a software engineer. So you've seen both sides of that. I would love to hear about like, how have you personally been able to grow into that? But also how are you working with people to kind of, you know, instead of just shove them along and say, go learn data. How are you working with them to, because their data engineers are a finite resource out there and often they're quite expensive to hire and find and all that.
Yeah, true. Well, on my side, I've struggled a lot with all of the good practices there is in software engineering, in software engineering. In software engineering, I'm thinking about design, like designing an application properly and thinking about the future, because it's not just designing pipelines and that's it. I'm not saying it's easy, but I had the good practice with my experience. It was also all of the tests, practice we have, how to test. So you think about the future and you make your software evolve easily. And I just spend a lot of time reading and working on side projects to learn, to apply, to have a lot of difficulties at home and solve them. I'm a bit passionate. So I don't ask for that in other people. So when I'm with a backend engineer, I just try to share what I know and why we should do this way, what it brings, and also saying, please read Designing Data Intensive Application.
Yeah, Pete Hine is actually doing a meetup next week, so that's that'll give people a little bit of information as to when this was recorded. But so for anybody who isn't aware, Pete Hine Strangholt wrote the book Designing Data Intensive Applications, that's Data Management at Scale. Who's the one that did Designing Data?
Martin Kleppmann.
Okay, Martin Kleppmann. That's sorry. Yes. Sorry, I totally got that one wrong. That's kind of, there are like four books that I think anybody who's really involved in a data mesh implementation should look at. It's that one. It's Data Management at Scale by Pete Hein-Strangholt. It's Team Topologies by Manuel Pais and Matt Skelton. And then, of course, obviously, the Zhemax book, right?
Obviously.
So like talking about that challenge of adding the data engineering capabilities, and maybe not that they're fully data engineering capable, but software engineers already have so many things that are on their plate. How are you working with them to incentivize them, to give them the space? You know, a big thing that I find when people are having software engineers push back and say, why should I do this? Is so many of the teams don't give them, don't go and rearrange their KPIs. So this is extra work instead of we're now moving it so that this is your work. This is a focus and we're making that actually part of your thing. So would love to hear how you're working on that, and maybe what you found that doesn't work, right? We talked a little bit in the pre-tape about trying to do a lot of one-to-one training. It just won't scale, right? You can't do one-to-one. So how do we find those vectors, those guild-like type of things to share that knowledge? Would love to hear what you've attempted, what's worked somewhat well, what's worked well, what isn't working that well, so people can maybe avoid this going down the same path and trying the same.
Maybe can I start? What didn't work was to force people. What's actually work is to find some curious developers that are searching for new ways of solving problems, and you eventually find them. And then to leverage them, to communicate on what they are doing and what new kind of problems they are solving. That's one of the aspects to not enforce this approach, but to find some advocates internally, to find actual projects that can be done easily with using a data product approach, and then communicate around that, making some return of experience and asking for new people to jump if they want. So it's work, but it's relatively slow.
I think you said this also last time, putting people in the same team, like having backend engineer and data engineer in the same team, and depending on the priorities of the quarter or whatever, maybe make them work in pair programming, either on a backend project or a data engineering project. If they are curious, both of them, because there is that engineer who don't want to do backend stuff and the other way around. So yeah, you have to go to have a very nice combination of luck, I say.
Another thing I think is to get ICs involved, senior engineers, staff engineers, architects, to see sweet spots and propose this kind of approach to teams that are not able to see the potential and the value.
One thing that you're talking about is something that I've tried to do a lot in my community work, which is look for mutually beneficial types of opportunities, right? I think that's what this podcast is for a lot of guests, is that it's beneficial to me because I get to learn a lot and have interesting conversations with fun people like yourself. But I also get to source good information for the community. But I think what the guests get is what's hopefully a fun conversation, but also to really think through what they've accomplished thus far and to reflect back and to get some other information about how other people might be handling the same challenges and things like that. And then, you know, obviously a lot of people get follow-up as well from listeners. So you can then start the conversation. People have a conversation starter. So I think that mutually beneficial is really important. And then, you know, that big picture as well of, hey, we know that you're focused on your really, really day-to-day work, but I think of this as paint by numbers. I don't know if you have that. In the US, there's these wine painting nights where you kind of have these things where everybody just gets together and just drinks a bunch of wine, and then they're supposed to paint this kind of generic picture. Or you have these pictures that they say, okay, you've got these outlines and you've got numbers in each of these, and you're supposed to use this color in number one and this color in number two and this. And so it creates the picture, but people are so focused on, are they in number one or are they in number two? So spreading that back and thinking about the big picture really does help them to get out of their own kind of world. But doing that in a way where it's like, this is beneficial. I would ask you, there's been a lot of talk about, it's kind of a weird phrase, and I haven't found a good way to use it other than, what is the genesis of your data products? Like, what is the what creates them? Is it that it is for the domain itself to use? So you talked, you know, Stephanie, you said this a little bit earlier in one of your things of like, this is to, if you're in a feature team, this is to help your own features. Is it that these data products are typically used more for the team itself? Or no, is it that they're used externally? Or, you know what I mean? Because we need to find that reusability so other teams can also use the domain's data. But does it have to start for, hey, domain, we're creating this thing initially that's good for you, but we're going to add to it. We're going to make it so that this creates the conversation so other domains can come in and start to say, could you add this? Could you add this? You know, the domain is kind of creating a data product of their data on the inside, and it's almost backwards, because then the data on the outside, the data that should be shared, people on the outside come and go, could you add this to what you're already doing? So sorry, long question, but it's something that's different in every organization. I think it's interesting to share what you're seeing and what's working.
You can go ahead.
Yeah, but I think that's the way you put it. It's easier to start with a business need that the feature team have, and then advertise on the data product to benefit to other teams. And we saw it with the way before when we switched to a microservice architectures. We at start, we have kind of a microlead, a microservice that had synchronous dependencies. And there was very few teams to use the event bus to async communication. And what had made things change was that some teams started to use their own event stream and build some cool stuff on it. And after this, it was really rapidly, even quickly used for cross-domain service-to-service communication. And then the event bus usage skyrocketed. So I think the same thing, that we have the tooling now, making data product, the data product realization possible for our feature team. First step is to build useful things for business needs. Second step is to use what other teams have built to enrich and construct cool stuff on it. And we have 50 feature teams, I think. So it's many domains with a lot of dependencies. And so consuming other domains interfaces is something that is pretty regular, that is in the habits of all teams. So having data product as just a new kind of interface is something that is easily sell to our feature teams.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting as well of we're seeing in data mesh that it's very difficult for a lot of people to design data products. And I think when you think of it as an interface between the teams, you know, that's how domain-driven design talks about, that this is a communication interface. And so I think that's useful, but I still, what I've heard from other organizations, and if you're not having this, then you're doing a lot of great things, but people want to know your secrets, which is, if domains are creating these data products that are specifically for their own business use case, how are other domains getting things into those data products or requesting data products that will be helpful for their own use cases? Because, you know, when we think about what data should be shared from, you know, I look at feature team A, feature team B, feature team C. Feature team A is only focusing on what feature team A should use from their data, and they make it so that other teams can leverage that. But at the organization level, a combination of data from feature team A, feature team B, and feature team C that is interoperable and that has information that maybe is not as useful for feature team A to leverage for their own things, right? You know, you can look at this with like clickstream data and things like that, where the domain may say, well, this data is not really that useful, but, you know, oh, okay, we're seeing how far somebody scrolls down a page is not that useful for somebody that's like, well, we're the, you know, cart team. We need to know how far somebody scrolled down before they add to the cart. But somebody that's on the kind of like user experience side might want to see, should we rearrange where things are? Are people reading, you know, are people scrolling way down and then we have to scroll way back up instead of, should I have a little floating button that goes down with you that says add to cart? Or like things like that where, okay, did somebody have to spend, you know, a second scrolling back up? That's frustrating. And so that's friction to actually adding to the cart and buying. So how are you finding those conversations about, you know, the data products themselves can be valuable in and of themselves. They should be in data mesh. But how do you get people to think about that broader picture and then do the work that's not necessarily going to help their own team?
Isn't this in our roadmap process? Like you define, I'm feature team A, and I'm saying I am doing this and this and that on this quarter, and I have a dependency on this feature team because I'm going to need this. So there is some kind of conversation like a few weeks before starting the next quarter.
Yeah, and that conversation is helped by staffs and architects that can point existing data products or other alternatives. And that's that occurs pretty naturally. There is also one thing with I go back to the introduction of the event bus. Feature teams can offer public event streaming around their domain, and in this kind of approach, all other teams can consume what it's public events, in this case, the domain owners tend to put all useful stuff concerning the domain inside the event, even if they don't use it directly. And so for me, we have the same kind of philosophy with data products. We start by addressing one local need, but we also have a reflection about what scope we want for the data product. Is it private? Is it something purely internal to the domain? Is it something that we can share, but in a one-to-one fashion? Or is it something that we are okay to open to other domains, other teams, and in which we will ensure some backward compatibility in the time, etc. And so this kind of thinking, we introduce them with the event bus 5 years ago, and we just have the same kind of thinking with data products. Are they private, internal of the domain, public? Okay, can I enrich, etc. I hope I'm clear, but
let's ask Scott.
Well, that's kind of interesting in that it's unique, because I don't think most organizations are really thinking about, they're thinking about the job at hand. So they're not doing extra work that isn't going to be useful for themselves. So it is you're in a happy situation where the teams are thinking empathetically about what could I be offering to other domains that may not be specifically helpful to me, but I'm still going to put it out there because
that's part of our of the governance, of the data governance we were talking about. So that's choices that we made 5 years ago. And yeah, it was really structurally very important for data reusing.
Or sharing.
Sharing, yeah. And so, yeah.
There is this, and there is also this this process in the roadmap reflection and building, but it's not because you ask for something in the dependency process that it's not because you ask it that it would be done in the next quarter. Maybe the team has other priorities, so you may have to negotiate. It's not. Like always very happy. Maybe you have to wait for a quarter or two.
Yeah, but for small development, it can be handled by super developers easy. And not going
to the whole process.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Off roadmap.
But it's also easier to do if you, as the domain, have already done that work up front, rather than having to respond to a request if you think about that up front. So I would love to understand a little bit about how you do interoperability then. Do you have standards that you do? Do you have like specific data modeling techniques or things like that? Do you have?
We have a kind of a dictionary of entities, from classic call entities inside the company, so a classified ad, users, etc. We have serialization protocol that are in force if you are building public data products. By example, if you are building an event stream on top of Kafka, you have to serialize it with Avro and ensure your transitive backward compatibility. If you do one-to-one if you do private stuff, you are able to do what you want to. And on the S3 part, Parquet is our standard.
And yeah, as soon as you have a public stream, as soon as you build a public stream, it is like automatically archived on S3.
We also have that's part of the data infrastructure tooling. When you build a public Kafka stream, you have the CI/CD that is helping you to handle all the evolution of all environments, but also create S3 buckets and Athena tables, and also handle the access control of all the stuff for by updating Vault for the circuit management between apps. So yeah, we have to sum up, we have some norms, and they are partially enforced by our tools.
I think that could be an interesting place to kind of wrap up the conversation around is you talked about that you already had federated governance. Most people are trying to figure out what the heck federated governance even means, right? Like it's difficult. So what would you say that has been the thing that you didn't anticipate, or what was the thing that's kind of saved your butt more times than you would have expected? You know, Adidas in one of their, they did a blog post, and what they said was every data product, every column is marked as PII by default. So that way any domain owner can feel comfortable that it's not going to be that they missed a column. It's more that they just said, oh, we forgot to mark this one as PII or as not PII because it's automatically marked as PII. So there's like a lot of these things, but like so far people are really trying to figure out what governance actually means in a decentralized world. So it's a very broad topic. I don't have a great specific question on it, but would love to hear kind of what you've done on governance, where you focused. Has it been more on access control? Have people understood how to do access control? Or are you focused more on the kind of global definitions and the interoperability? Or like what, if you were if somebody said, how do I do federated governance? Where would you tell them to start? And where would you tell them that it's okay to leave until later, until you figured it out a bit more?
I would say follow the pain and start by pain points that are points by the teams. Something that has worked very well for us was to write some RFCs around we put data engineers and backend engineers inside the same room, say, okay, what do we want to normalize? What are the acceptable choices? What are the edge cases? Okay, write down a proposition on a request for comment mode. And after 1 month, implemented it inside our CI/CD tool. And I think that was a game changer, not writing the RFCs, but making them enforced by tooling and making everybody using directly the data infra provisioner tooling rather than going through their ops to provide infrastructure by themselves.
Agreed.
And because when you do that, you don't have to choose between do I want to focus on PII, on consistency of Kafka configurations, on answering environment consistencies, etc. You can do everything by code and offer a clean abstraction to developers to make this kind of easy.
I think that's a secret sauce that I'm hearing from a lot of people, is that it's not that it's enforced by tooling in a certain sense, but it's more, they don't have to invent it from scratch.
Yeah.
You go, hey, you know, the conversation or the interview question that's the worst in the world is, so tell me about yourself, right? That's not a thing. You know, I'll let people behind the curtain a little bit. Before we start episodes, I tell people, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself. If I just did that without saying it to people, it kind of can, you know, when I first started doing that, it kind of caught them off guard, because it's like, what do I say about myself? And so, like, okay, create a data product. Well, what do you mean? Like, what is this versus, okay, what are some sensible defaults? What are some SLAs that you want to do? What are some ways of handling these things that other people are doing? And you can leverage the existing things and that you click it and say, yeah, I'll use it this way. Yeah, I'll do it that way. That sounds good to me. And so it's a suggestion. And so if it doesn't fit, they can push back and say that thing doesn't fit. But outside of that, they're able to control so much of what they're looking at. So I think that's a pattern that I'm seeing from people being successful that's coming through a lot. So it's good to hear you're seeing the same thing and that's kind of similar. So we bounced around a lot of different things. Is there anything we didn't cover that you think, I know we had planned to talk a little bit more about the exact organizational thing and like working within the of getting backend engineers to really understand data and stuff. But I think we covered a lot of interesting other ground as well. But is there anything we didn't cover that you think is important, or is there any way that you'd like to kind of wrap up the conversation?
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot. My only thing I like to finish on would be like, yeah, bet on curious people and make them talk to each other.
There was one episode about domain-driven design for data, and the person at the end, Danilo Sato, said, you know, it's like, is there any way you want to wrap it up? And he's like, just have people talk to each other.
It seems obvious, right?
Engineers want to make it so that this is done via technology, that it's done via the tooling instead of like high context exchange of like, there are things where, you know, when you think about the documentation, you can't actually put everything you could ever need in the documentation you need an ability to go and ask that person, right? And I think this is the same thing of like, you can't anticipate every need, and having a high empathy organization to actually communicate with each other is really important. So I fully agree on that.
Yeah, to put it in other words, I think to use team topologies vocabulary, you have to lower the cognitive cost of the data engineering or data infra tooling, and put those tools inside hands of curious people and making them communicate.
Yeah, I think that user experience, people talk about the experience plane in data mesh, and it's like the experience plane, is that just for the data consumers? No, it's very much for the data
producers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pure DevX.
Yeah. So this has been super amazing. I think it's going to be helpful for a lot of people to kind of hear about the journey and what you've learned thus far. If people do want to follow up with you, where is the best place? And what would you like them following up about? Is there kind of a call to action for whether you've got things that you think you've figured out and if people are having those challenges? Or if there are questions that you still have and you want to talk with other people and say, hey, we haven't figured this out, let's exchange information. Is there anything, best place and what would you like?
Okay, best place, very originally, LinkedIn and Twitter. and yeah, well, there are many subjects that are very interesting to discuss. The ones that emerge naturally previously on how do you handle job position and how in your organization can you make things converge more naturally around engineering stuff? those kind of topic I would be very happy to discuss with anybody with a point of view.
And on my side, yeah, Twitter and LinkedIn too. and I'd love to talk, discuss about engineering communities, like internal or even external. Maybe data pipeline architecture, what's going on out there.
Yeah.
And
she wants you to build data pipeline with Kotlin.
And yeah, convergence of those two job positions.
Yeah, Jamak has talked about in her vision of the future that there are no data engineers. It's just everybody's a software engineer, and you might have a bit more data focus, but our tooling right now is not there where people that the software engineers can really learn this. And that if we just say, you've now got to learn data, you know, full stack engineers, okay, now you've got to do front end, back end, and data. No, that's too much cognitive load, right? So,
yeah, but back end and data. Like at the end of the day, we just make the data move, like maybe more as data engineer, but.
Yeah, I hope we can get there, but I think right now we've separated it too much, and that the tooling and the knowledge is just kind of separated across the industry. So if we can do that, it would be great. I hope we can get there. But again, this has been such a great conversation, Stephanie and Simon. You know, I really want to thank you for taking the time today to chat with me, and I want to thank everyone as well at home for listening.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
I'd again like to thank my guests today, Stephanie Bergamo, who's a lead data engineer, and Simon Moron, who's a lead architect at LeBoncoin. You can find links to both of their Twitters and LinkedIn profiles in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full-time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.